Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Unitarian Church on St. Stephen's Green. Welcome if you're joining us on the webcam. Welcome, Bill, if you're listening this morning. And I have to mention my friend Jean Marie, who listens in from Tennessee in the USA in the early hours of the morning. Hi, Jean Marie. Welcome if you're listening back on the podcast during the week. And welcome if you're here this morning in person. We are glad that you are here. My name is Will O'Connell. I'm a member of the congregation here. Those of you familiar with the church will know that members of the congregation sometimes take the services here. It's to hear other voices from the pulpit, but more importantly, to give our minister, Bridget Spain, a break. So if I do anything right today, I'll have done that. I'll have given Bridget a break, and I'm sure it's very welcome. If this is your first time here, or your 101st time here, we are glad you are here. If you carry the weight of a weary world on your shoulders, or you entered through the doors with a song in your heart and a skip in your step, we are glad you are here. If you are the loudest voice in the town square, or the subtle hand behind the scenes, we are glad you are here. If you have failed once or 1,000 times, we are glad you are here. If you sing like angels or mumble behind the hymnal, we are glad you are here. This community is what it is because of your presence. So welcome. Welcome into this space of love, support, justice, compassion, fellowship, and worship. We are glad you are here. We'll now have our chalice lighting. If ever there were a time for a candle in the darkness, this would be it. Using a spark of hope, kindle the flame of love, ignite the light of peace, and feed the flame of justice. And we'll now have our first hymn, the familiar For the Beauty of the Earth, number 21. We need one another. We need one another when we mourn and would be comforted. We need one another when we are in trouble and afraid. We need one another when we are in despair, in temptation, and need to be recalled to our best selves again. We need one another when we would accomplish some great purpose and cannot do it alone. We need one another in the hour of success, when we look for someone to share our triumphs. We need one another in the hour of defeat, when with encouragement we might endure and stand again. We need one another when we come to die and would have gentle hands prepare us for the journey. All our lives we are in need, and others are in need of us. The choir will now sing words that attempt to articulate the aspirations of our church. Thanks so much to the choir. Just to say that music was written by our friend John Ward, who's no longer with us in here, but I believe he's somewhere else. And John was a militant atheist. I don't know if he'd mind me using that term. But it's nice to be able to sort of imagine him there going, see, I told you. Or else he's saying to me, anyway. But John Ward wrote that. So thank you to the choir for singing it. And now Dirren is our reader today, so she'll take off her chorister's hat and come up and read our first reading. Thanks, dear.
Good morning. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the podcast Poetry Unbound, but I'm a huge fan of it. It's presented by an Irish poet called Padraig O'Toole, although it comes out of the stable of the On Being studios in Minneapolis, and some of you may be familiar with their podcasts as well. But what he does is he takes a poem from anywhere in the English language speaking world, so there's a fantastic range of stuff there. He reads it, then he gives you a little bit of context, how it was written, when it was written, and a bit of analysis from his perspective. Your perspective might be completely different. And then he reads the poem again in the light of what he's been just saying. The whole thing takes under 15 minutes. Anyway, just before Christmas, he brought out this book called Poetry Unbound, 50 poems to open your world. And he has taken 50 of the hundreds of poems that he has on the podcast and given his commentary. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read one of the poems that he has here, and I'm going to read just a few extracts from his commentary and context setting, and then I'll do what he does, and I'll read the poem again, if that's all right. So the poem is called A Portable Paradise, and it's by Roger Robinson. And if I speak of paradise, then I'm speaking of my grandmother, who told me to carry it always on my person, concealed, so no one else would know but me. That way, they can't steal it, she'd say. And if life puts you under pressure, trace its ridges in your pocket. Smell its piney scent on your handkerchief. Hum its anthem under your breath. And if your stresses are sustained and daily, get yourself to an empty room, be it hotel, hostel, or hovel. Find a lamp and empty your paradise onto a desk. Your white sands, green hills, and fresh fish. Shine the lamp on it like the fresh hope of morning, and keep staring at it till you sleep. A Portable Paradise is the final poem in Roger Robinson's collection of the same name. It pays serious attention to the question of comfort, especially in times of distress. The book's opening poems are words of pastoral care addressed to the residents of Grenfell, a 24-story tower block in London, a building clad in material that didn't comply with building regulations. In 2017, what would otherwise have been a household fire caused the whole building to go up, killing 72 people. People had raised the alarm about the danger of that cladding in the years leading up to the fire, but the social housing authorities did not do the work, most likely because the residents were black and brown and working class, and therefore not considered important enough to listen to. Roger Robinson is a Trinidadian poet who has moved back and forth between London and Trinidad, so he's made a home in a few places. Place can be a memory holder for paradise or pain. Paradise for Roger Robinson is found in a shell held inside your pocket, or in the piney scent of a handkerchief, or in the music you keep in your ears. In his poem, the paradise needs to be portable because there are people who wish to steal it. Carry it always on your person, concealed, his grandmother warns him. Her voice is loving and long-lived. Those are just extracts from the longer piece Padraig O'Thoma wrote. So I'll read you the poem once more. And if I speak of paradise, then I'm speaking of my grandmother, who told me to carry it always on my person, concealed, so no one else would know but me. That way, they can't steal it, she'd say. And if life puts you under pressure, trace its ridges in your pocket. Smell its piney scent on your handkerchief. Hum its anthem under your breath. And if your stresses are sustained and daily, get yourself to an empty room, be it hotel, hostel, or hovel. Find a lamp and empty your paradise onto a desk. Your white sands, green hills, fresh fish. Shine the lamp on it like the fresh hope of morning and keep staring at it till you sleep.
Thanks so much, Darren. Now is the time for the children's story I don't see apart from Eve. And I hope to tell Eve this story a little later on in the future when she might understand it. But I don't see any children, so I'm not going to invite them down to the front. But I'll read it anyway for the adults. It's one of my favourite stories, and it's in Bill's wonderful book, Concentration and Compassion, More Stories from the World's Spiritual Traditions. The book is available on the church's website if anybody doesn't have a copy and wants one. And whenever there's a baby naming ceremony here in the church, it's a gift that's given to... But there's some beautiful stories. But I've read this one before, but I love it so much. I think it's worth reading again and reminding ourselves of this wonderful story called Peter's Parrot. Peter really wanted a pet, so he went to the pet shop to have a look around. His eye was immediately drawn to the most beautiful parrot. "I really like the look of that parrot," he said to the pet shop owner. "Can it talk?" "Well, it's a brilliant talker," said the shopkeeper. "It has a vocabulary of 100 words. Not only will it amaze all your friends, but it will keep you entertained for hours." "How much is it?" said Peter. €50, and cheap at the price. Would you like a cage?" "Certainly," said Peter. "How much?" €20. "What about a perch?" "How much?" €20. Well, Peter paid the €90, and he took the parrot, the cage, and the perch home. He was very much looking forward to hearing the parrot talk, but it didn't. For 24 hours, it sat on its perch in the cage, but apart from the occasional squawk, it didn't utter a word. The next day, Peter returned to the shop. "Excuse me," he said to the shopkeeper, "I bought a parrot here yesterday, and you told me it was a brilliant talker, but it hasn't said a word yet." "How strange," said the shopkeeper. "You mean to say that it swung on its little swing and it never spoke a word?" "Well, you never mentioned anything about a swing." "Well, every parrot needs a little swing. A parrot won't talk unless it has a swing." "How much?" asked Peter. €20. So Peter bought the swing and he fixed it in the cage. The parrot swung merrily all day, but it still didn't talk. So Peter went back to the shop. "Excuse me," he said to the shopkeeper, "I bought a parrot here 2 days ago. You told me it could talk really well, but it still hasn't said a word." "Oh dear," said the shopkeeper. "You mean that it's been swinging on its little swing and climbing its little ladder and it still hasn't spoken?" "Well, wait a minute," said Peter. "You never mentioned anything about a ladder." "Oh, a parrot needs a ladder. Everyone knows that. A parrot won't talk unless it has a ladder to climb." "Well, how much is the ladder?" €20. So Peter bought the ladder and he put it in the parrot's cage. The parrot swung on its swing and climbed its ladder, but it still didn't talk. So Peter returned to the shop. "Excuse me," he said, "3 days ago I bought a parrot. You said it could talk very well, but it still hasn't said a word." "Goodness," said the man, "you mean to say that it swung on its little swing, climbed its little ladder, rung its little bell, and it still hasn't spoken?" "You never mentioned a bell." "Well, everyone knows that a parrot won't talk unless it has a little bell to ring." "How much?" asked Peter. €20. So Peter bought the bell, he took it home and he fixed it in the cage. The parrot merrily swung on its swing, climbed its little ladder, and rung its little bell, but it didn't talk. In fact, it died. It fell off its perch and landed on the cage floor. It was stone dead. So Peter went back to the shop. "Excuse me," he said. 4 days ago, I bought a parrot which you said could talk very well. I've also bought a cage, a perch, a swing, a ladder, and a bell. I've spent €150, and this morning the parrot dropped down dead." "Oh, I'm very sorry to hear that," said the shopkeeper. "Did he speak before he died?" "Well, yes, he did, as it happens. His final and only words were, 'Didn't that stupid money-grabbing shopkeeper say anything about some bird seed?'" We'll now have our second hymn, and it's a little unfamiliar to us. It's number 163, "For the Earth Forever Turning." And Josh will play the final line in refrain after each verse. But we'll give it a go. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
For my reading, I've chosen a piece called An Emotional Rescue by a writer called Gina Barreca. Ready for some tough questions this morning? What's your demon? What's your nightmare? What wakes you up in the middle of the night? Not in fear, but in the threshing buzz of low-grade panic. The dread of being alone, of getting older, of illness, of death, of being unable to help alleviate the sadness of those close to you. I have a friend, a woman I consider one of the blessings in my life, who is facing a whole bunch of those nightmares right now. Her nightmares are sitting there at the kitchen table with her. Maybe you know her. Maybe you are her. Many of us have been where she is, in the dark night of the soul, at some point. But when you are inside the tumble and hiss of the bad time, it is almost impossible to imagine rescue or survival. But we, more or less, survive. Either the worst happens, or it doesn't. We brush up against the savage edge of loss and cut ourselves, counting ourselves lucky to have been only scarred, only mangled. Because there are worse possibilities. Those times when you can't back away and you can't move out of range, the edge saws away until it can no longer be borne. Or change the image. The hurricane that obliterates everything in its path goes through a place we once thought safe, as if to teach one lesson. Nowhere is safe, at least not forever. At least not all the time. Happy times and bad times move through our lives like the weather. There are accurate predictions to be made, but there is nothing to be done when a force of nature moves in. You can see the horizon darkening, but whether you run to it or flee from it, you cannot change what will happen. You are stuck in that moment of time with only yourself as your shelter. So what is there to say when someone you love is deep inside that storm? Or change the image again. What is there to say when a friend is playing a part in a great tragedy on a stage too removed, too terrible, and too awesome for you to offer help? You can't shout out the lines because the script is not yours to invent. You can't offer to replace her in the part because it's not your role. What is there to say that does not trivialize pain by offering sentimentality, or that does not show disrespect by offering mere palliatives? What I want to say to my friend is this. I honor you as you move through this time, not as a martyr or saint full of gracious sorrow, but as a fighter, as a warrior, as someone engaged in a contest for her soul, as someone who refuses to surrender to despair or to plot a coward's escape. And I would remind her of an old story. Late one night, three demons decided to ambush a woman who lived alone. The three demons were manifestations of her worst nightmares, fear, anxiety, and despair. They made a racket, breaking things, ruining what she held dear, disfiguring what she cherished. Gleefully, they spent hours immersed in their rampage. They were enormously confident because they figured she was all alone and past her first youth, so why should they stop? They went at it for hours, into the darkest part of midnight. The woman they were tormenting was almost inconsequential. The destruction of her world had little to do with her. When she started to build a fire at the hearth, therefore, they barely glanced over. But the demons became more thoroughly distracted when they noticed her busily setting out a kettle. Wary now, they ratcheted up their activities. When she calmly set out three cups, nevertheless, they stopped in their tracks. Her hands weren't even shaking. She looked calm, if weary. "What are you doing?" they cried in unison, breathless from their tasks of destruction. "We are everything in the world that is against you. Why are you boiling water and setting out dishes?" The woman stared at them and tolerantly shook her head as she opened the cupboard. "I know all of you by now. You've been here before, and you'll be here again. You might as well make yourselves at home." Raising one eyebrow and fully meeting their gaze without rancor, wholly in possession of herself, she asked familiarly, "What kind of tea would you like?" We'll shortly move into a time of silence for our own reflections. And this silence will be brought to an end by Circa and Gronja singing. It's something we plan to do at the beginning of the pandemic, and we haven't been able to do it. There was a time when singing was considered a dangerous pursuit, so it's so wonderful that we can do that today. But we'll have a moment of silence after this short prayer. Dear God, we give thanks for places of simplicity and peace. Let us find such a place within ourselves. We give thanks for places of refuge and beauty. Let us find such a place within ourselves. We give thanks for places of nature's truth and freedom, of joy, inspiration, and renewal, places where all creatures may find acceptance and belonging. Let us search for these places in the world, in ourselves, and in others. Let us restore them. Let us strengthen and protect them, and let us create them. May we mend this outer world according to the truth of our inner life, and may our souls be shaped and nourished by nature's eternal wisdom.
If it be your will that I speak no more and my voice be still as it was before, I will speak no more. I shall if it be your will. If it be your will that a voice be true from this broken hill, I will sing to you. From this broken hill, all your praises they shall ring. If it be your will to let me sing, if it be your will, if there is a choice, let the rivers fill, let the hills rejoice, let your mercy spill on all these burning hearts in hell. If it be your will to make us well, near, oh, bind us tight, all your children here in their rags of light, in our rags of light, all dressed to kill and end this night. If it be your will, and end this night, if it be your will. Ooh, 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 if it be.
Thanks so much, Circa and Gronia. It's a family affair today. Circa and Gronia are Darren's daughters. She must be very proud. Thanks for doing that. If it be your will that I speak no more, and my voice be still as it were before, I shall speak no more, I shall abide until I am spoken for, if it be your will. What incredible words to write. Leonard Cohen said that those words were essentially a prayer. But to have that level of acceptance for our place in the world, if it be your will that I speak no more. That's a remarkable thing. Today I'm going to be speaking about something called radical acceptance. And I feel like I should preface what I'm about to say with a little caveat, as in I feel so unqualified, I suppose, to stand up here and talk about radical acceptance, because there is nobody in this church who needs to use radical acceptance more than me. Absolutely not. And the more I tried to come up with a talk to explain radical acceptance, the more I needed to practice radical acceptance on myself. So it was this kind of strange thing of the creature eating itself, the Ouroboros eating its own tail. But I will do my best to articulate some of the important points about radical acceptance. And I'll start with a quote that has meant a lot. It's not me, is it? No, it's not. Sorry, Mum, I can't. Not right now. Anyway, it's not me. I'll start with a quote that's meant a lot to me over the last 20 years. You're going to have to sing again, Gronia. Yeah. Eve was here at our rehearsal during the week, and she was amazing. She just delighted in the song. So, I start with a quote that means a lot to me, and it has for the last 20 years or so. It's a quotation from the so-called Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the basic text. And it's a quote on acceptance that will be very familiar to anyone who's taken part in a 12-step program, but it goes like this. And acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I am disturbed, it is because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact of my life, unacceptable to me. And I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it is supposed to be at this moment. Nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. Unless I accept life completely on life's terms, I cannot be happy. I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in the world as on what needs to be changed in me and in my attitudes. What I particularly love about that saying is it starts by saying, when I am disturbed, it's because I find some person, place, or thing, or situation, some fact of my life, unacceptable to me. What that saying does is it directs me to the source of my problem, me. You know, there's that phrase, if you're pointing the finger, there are three pointing back at you, that I like to remember. When I have a problem, I have a problem. I am the problem, and I can find no peace of mind until I find acceptance. So the topic of this address is radical acceptance. And radical acceptance is a term whose first use can be traced back to Marsha Linehan in the 1990s. Marsha Linehan is a psychologist, author, and the developer of something called dialectical behavior therapy, or DBT. It's something that was new to me. I hadn't heard of it before. Maybe some of you have, but it is a branch of the more commonly known cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. But DBT has achieved remarkable results in the treatment of psychiatric patients at the most extreme end of the spectrum, those with severe self-harming and life-threatening behaviors, perhaps those who were considered hopeless causes. But Marsha Linehan takes pride in helping the most vulnerable of people and has dedicated herself to the most difficult and intransigent psychiatric cases. The main philosophy of dialectical behavior therapy is to create a life worth living. This philosophy is characterized by balancing the need to become aware of and accept things in life that you can't change, while simultaneously working on the things which you can to improve your emotional well-being and overall quality of life. Another anchor of the AA program, the Serenity Prayer, which I love, in a way, this philosophy is like living the embodiment of the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. DBT places us in the very center of that prayer. The word dialectic means to examine, discuss, and reconcile opposing ideas. An example of such opposing ideas might be, I am doing the best that I can. but I also need to try harder. I am anxious, but I am okay. Marcia Linehan describes radical acceptance as follows. Radical acceptance rests on letting go of the illusion of control and a willingness to notice and accept things as they are right now, without judging. It is a complete and total openness to the facts of reality as they are, without throwing a tantrum and growing angry. Tara Brach, who some of you may have heard of, is a Buddhist teacher, a psychologist, and an author, and she is one of the foremost exponents of the theory of radical acceptance. She's written several books, hosted podcasts, and led guided meditations on the topic. She says the following. For so many of us, feelings of deficiency are right around the corner. It doesn't take much. Just hearing of someone else's accomplishments, being criticized, getting into an argument, making a mistake at work, to make us feel that we are not okay. Or as a friend of hers put it, feeling that something is wrong with me is the invisible and toxic gas I am always breathing. When we experience our lives through this lens of personal insufficiency, we are imprisoned in what I call the trance of unworthiness. These are her words, not mine. Trapped in this trance, we are unable to perceive the truth of who we really are. And Tara Brach shares a story as an example. A meditation student at a retreat I was teaching told me about an experience that brought home to her the tragedy of living in a trance. Marilyn had spent many hours sitting at the bedside of her dying mother, reading to her, meditating to her late at night, holding her hand, and telling her over and over that she loved her. Most of the time, Marilyn's mother remained unconscious, her breath labored and erratic. One morning before dawn, she suddenly opened her eyes and looked clearly and intently at her daughter. "You know," she whispered softly, "all my life I thought something was wrong with me." Shaking her head slightly as if to say, "What a waste." She closed her eyes and drifted back into a coma. Several hours later, she passed away. We don't have to wait until we're on our deathbed to realize what a waste of our precious lives it is to carry the belief that something is wrong with us, that because of our habits of feeling insufficient, because they're so strong, awakening from the trance involves not only inner resolve, but also an active training of the heart and mind. Through awareness practices, we can free ourselves from the suffering of trance by learning to recognize what is true in the present moment and by embracing whatever we see with an open heart. This cultivation of mindfulness and compassion is what Tara Brach calls radical acceptance. And she says, radical acceptance reverses our habit of living at war with experiences that are unfamiliar, frightening, or intense. It is the necessary antidote to years of neglecting ourselves, years of judging and treating ourselves harshly, years of rejecting this moment's experience. Radical acceptance is the willingness to experience ourselves and our life as it is. A moment of radical acceptance is a moment of genuine freedom. When we practice radical acceptance, we begin with the fears and wounds of our own life and discover that our heart of compassion widens endlessly. In holding ourselves with compassion, we become free to love this living world. This is the blessing of radical acceptance. As we free ourselves from the suffering of something is wrong with me, we trust and express the fullness of who we are. Now, the first important point to make about the practice of radical acceptance is that by radically accepting a certain situation, that doesn't mean that we approve of the situation. We're just accepting the situation as it is right now. And this acceptance allows us to see more clearly what steps can be taken to change the situation. The American psychologist Carl Rogers explains in his book On Becoming a Person, "I find I am more effective when I can listen acceptantly to myself and can be myself. I feel that over the years I have learned to become more adequate in listening to myself so that I know, somewhat more adequately than I used to, what I am feeling in any given moment. One way of putting this is that I feel I have become more adequate in letting myself be what I am. It becomes easier for me to accept myself as a decidedly imperfect person who by no means functions at all times in the way in which I would like to function. This must seem to some like a very strange direction in which to move. It seems to me to have value because the curious paradox is that when I accept myself just as I am, then I change. The curious paradox is that when I accept myself as I am, then I change. If we are stuck in the denial or non-acceptance of the situation, then it makes changing that situation very difficult, because it's only with a true and honest evaluation that we can begin to move forward. The truth sets us free, and radical acceptance is shining the light of truth on a situation, not judgment, just truth. Practicing radical acceptance can bring true freedom from a whole host of problems. You've probably heard the saying, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. The quotation has often been misattributed to the Buddha or the Dalai Lama, but the message is the important part. Pain is an inevitable part of life. Suffering can come from not accepting the pain. So what can we do in order to radically accept something? I mean, it's okay to say that we just need to accept it. We might know that on an intuitive level, but what practical steps can be taken in order to help us toward a path of radical acceptance on a deeper level? So Marsha Linehan offers some directions on how to take practical steps towards radical acceptance. And I need the practical. If it's not practical, it's not spiritual in my word. I need in my world. So here are some practical steps. The first, she says, is to observe. Just notice when you are fighting or resisting reality. You might be saying, it shouldn't be this way. You might find yourself saying, I should have done that, or I could have. The first step is just about noticing these thoughts. Second part is to look at the reality. Remind yourself that the unpleasant reality is just as it is and it cannot be changed. This is what happened. Number three, the reason. Remind yourself that there are causes for this reality. This is how things happened. You can notice how reality took shape and came to be because reality has causes. It just didn't appear out of anywhere. Number four, practice. Practice accepting with your whole self, your mind, body, and spirit. Use accepting self-talk, relaxation techniques, mindfulness, and or imagery. Number five, list. List all of the behaviors that you would engage in if you did accept the facts, and then try to engage in those behaviors as if you have already accepted the facts. Number six, imagine. Imagine in your mind's eye believing what you do not want to accept and rehearse what you would do if you accepted what seems unacceptable. Attend to the body sensations as you think what you need to accept. Sit with the feelings is another word for that, I suppose. Just imagining that you accept it and then sitting and listening to what happens in the body. And then allow disappointment, sadness, or grief to arise within you. Number nine, acknowledge. Acknowledge that life can be worth living even when there is pain. And lastly, pros and cons. Martha Linehan suggests doing a pros and cons list if you find yourself resisting practicing acceptance. Another way to practice radical acceptance when you're dealing with these emotions, thoughts, or a situation that you have a hard time accepting is to use what are known as coping statements. And these statements are meant to remind us that there are some things we can't change. By accepting reality as it is, we can free ourselves from emotional tension and judging thoughts. Some examples of these statements might be, the present moment is the only one I have control over. Fighting my current emotions and thoughts only gives them more fuel to thrive. This moment is precisely as it should be, even though I might not like it. I cannot change what has happened in the past. I accept this moment as it is. And lastly, although my emotions are uncomfortable, I will get through it. This too shall pass. But I would say one of the most important practices of radical acceptance is learning to treat ourselves with compassion. So often when bad things happen to us, we compound our suffering by blaming ourselves for what happened or by telling ourselves that we are bad. So we double down on ourselves and inflict even more pain. Tara Brach writes on forgiveness, forgiving ourselves is a process that continues through our whole life. We are so used to replaying the story of what is wrong with ourselves and others that living with a resentful, tight heart can become our most familiar way of being. Thousands of times we might find ourselves caught in stories of what we are doing wrong. Thousands of times we might drop under our blame to where the deeper pain lives. With each round of freeing ourselves through forgiveness, we strengthen our recognition of our basic goodness. With time, forgiving ourselves utterly transfigures our life. As well as forgiving ourselves, reflecting on our own goodness can be a powerful tool to help us counteract negative feelings of blame. Tara Brach writes, "Reflecting on our own goodness is vital because it opens our hearts and invigorates our faith in our spiritual unfolding. If we're caught up in considering ourselves bad, we contract and hide. In contrast, if we trust our goodness, we open up to others. We feel inspired to help others. We move forward on our spiritual path with dedication and joy. There are several practices that are traditionally offered as ways to remember our goodness. We might begin by simply reflecting on certain qualities or behaviors that we appreciate in ourselves. For instance, when I recall instances of being kind to someone, I can taste the sweetness of being caring and generous. I might remember a time when I put aside my own agenda to stop and listen deeply to someone, or spontaneously gave a friend a book they might like. When I feel moved by the music of Mozart or awed by a starry night sky, I feel part of the goodness and beauty of life. When life strikes me as funny, I feel real and human and basically good." Sometimes, though, the idea of appreciating ourselves can feel awkward or self-serving. When this is the case, it can be more honest to acknowledge our basic desire to be happy, to recognize that, to recognize that I, like all human beings, long to be loved, yearn to feel my goodness. When I pay attention to the depth of these longings, I reconnect to a genuine feeling of warmth towards myself. Sometimes the easiest way to appreciate ourselves is by looking through the eyes of someone who loves us. A friend told me that when he sees himself through the eyes of his spiritual teacher, he remembers how deeply devoted he is to seeking the truth. One of Tara Brach's clients realizes that they are lovable when they remember how their grandfather used to delight in their boyish curiosity and inventiveness. And sometimes seeing ourselves through the eyes of a close friend can help us to remember our good qualities. Our friend might love our humor and warmth, our passion about saving the environment, our honest willingness to say what's really going on in our lives. And we don't have to limit our appreciators to the human world. I once saw a bumper sticker that said, "Lord, help me to see myself the way my dog sees me." We might ask ourselves, what makes our dog happy to see us? Even if the answer is just that he wants to get fed or walked, our animal's appreciation of our constancy reflects an aspect of us that is worthy. The practice of looking through the eyes of one who loves us can be a powerful and surprisingly direct way to remember our beauty and goodness. Through the simple practice of seeing our own goodness, we undo the deeply rooted habits of blame and self-hate that keep us feeling isolated and unworthy. And in closing, these words are from the Indian master Yogi Bapuji and quoted in Tara Brach's book. "My beloved child, break your heart no longer. Each time you judge yourself, you break your own heart. You stop feeding on the love which is the wellspring of your vitality. The time has come, your time, to live, to celebrate, and to see the goodness that you are. Let no one, no thing, no idea or ideal obstruct you. If one comes, even in the name of truth, forgive it for its unknowing. Do not fight. Let go and breathe into the goodness that you are." When we live in awareness, we live in love. Although we drift on the path and lose sight of our essential being, remembering what we love guides us back to a sacred presence. If we can only remember to pause and reflect on what we love, therein lies the peace and freedom of radical acceptance. Amen. So we will now have our offertory collection, and we'll sing our third hymn, which is number 23, "Bring Many Names."
Thank you.
our notices. Fair trade tea and coffee will be served downstairs straight after the service. Please do join us. Wednesday lunchtime meditation. Pamela McCarthy leads our weekly lunchtime meditation service in the church from 1:05 until 1:05 to 1:35. And these sessions can also be accessed live on our webcam. The book club will be meeting this week, this coming week, on Zoom on Wednesday at 7:30 p.m. Please log in at 7:15 for the 7:30 start at the usual link. And the book is Girl, Woman, Other by Bernardine Evaristo. Just a note about the rota. The services that happen involve so many people, and I'll say thank you to those in a moment. But if you would like to help out in any way in the church, please come and speak to me afterwards. I compiled a list of volunteers for welcoming at the church, bringing flowers, helping with tea and coffee downstairs, reading. So if you would like to get involved in any small way, maybe speak to me afterwards. Andy wants to say something. It's a family affair today.
It's not very often that anybody writes a novel about Irish Unitarians. In fact, this novel, which is going to be launched in the church this afternoon, I think is the first ever. It's a book by Liz McManus. It's a novel by Liz McManus, former deputy leader of the Labour Party, who comes from a Unitarian family background and has become a relatively regular attender at our services. So Liz is launching this book, When Things Come to Light, which is a novel based on the story of her own Unitarian family at 2:30 this afternoon. Is it in the church or downstairs, Bridget? Downstairs in the Damer Hall at 2:30. And she asks me to say that everybody is welcome. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Andy. Just some thanks. Thanks very much, Kevin, as always, for setting up and keeping the church warm for us and getting everything ready. For Bridget, for encouraging me to lead today. To Darren for the reading. Thank you, Darren. Josh and the choir for the beautiful music and the singing. Circa and Grona, thank you so much. That was very special. To our welcomer, Paula, and also for the flowers. And Paula is going to run downstairs and help out with coffee. We really need volunteers. We need volunteers. Some people are really going the extra mile, but if you can help, we'd love that. And also Michael and Trish are going to help with the coffee as well downstairs. So thank you to them all. We will now have our final hymn, and it is hymn number 108, which is My Life Flows On in Endless Song. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you. God, give us rain when we expect sun. Give us music when we expect trouble. Give us tears when we expect breakfast. Give us dreams when we expect a storm. Give us a stray dog when we expect congratulations. God, play with us. Turn us sideways and around. Amen.